I'm William Shutkin.
And I'm Andy Bush.
Welcome to the Sustainable City Show, a new podcast where we discuss bold ideas and innovations for green, equitable, and climate-friendly cities with the people making them happen. Today's show, we're looking at sustainability, health, and wellness in buildings and real estate. Beyond a zero-carbon built environment, what other goals should we be aiming for in creating better, greener cities? And how do we get there? To help us answer these questions, we have two outstanding guests today. First is Brad Jacobson. Brad is an architect and principal at EHDD, a San Francisco-based architecture firm which is leading the way towards a carbon-neutral built environment. Brad has led the design teams for a wide range of climate-conscious projects, including two AIA top 10 green buildings, the Net Zero Energy and LEED Platinum certified headquarters for the David and Lucille Packard Foundation, and the Department of Global Ecology for the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University. He is currently leading the collaborative design build delivery of a 330,000 square foot high-tech office campus targeting LEED Platinum and carbon neutral performance. Our next guest is Elena Ladner. Elena leads the sustainability practice at Jones Lang LaSalle's Project and Development Services Unit in the West. With experience as a commercial architect, she brings a balanced perspective to the full cycle of commercial real estate and is a trusted sustainability advisor. Notable assignments include interior design and sustainability strategy for Boulder Commons, developed by our own Andy Bush and Morgan Creek Ventures, a net zero energy multi-tenant office development. And she's currently assisting clients with sustainability program development and portfolio-wide net zero carbon pathway evaluations. Let's start our show. Andy?
Great. Well, fortunately, I've been able to work with both Brad and Elena over the last decade, and it's been a pretty interesting experience. So I'm excited to be able to do this on the show. And I think we're going to come at it from kind of two different perspectives that don't really compete. They're additive, but one is, what's the leading edge of the technical side of the sustainable world right now? And Brad, I'd have you just give some initial thoughts on that first, and then shift to Elena. And Elena, come at it from a different angle, which is, these buildings are meant to house people, and what's kind of the people perspective or wellness perspective? And then we'll intertwine that over the next hour or so.
Great. Andy, Bill, thanks for inviting us. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I'd say there's a lot of fascinating materials coming online, especially around envelope. I think there's a lot of great glass technology. Andy, you and I installed the triple element glazing at Boulder Commons, which is a great example that's still making its way into the mainstream. I mean, so that kind of glass is, in a very thin envelope of glass can really create great insulation and better comfort for people. There's also a big emphasis these days on really understanding the carbon content of materials and finding ways to develop materials that are significantly lower carbon. Even on structural materials, that's become a big emphasis. Concrete is probably the toughest nut to crack. There's substitutions for cement and other aspects of the mix that are helping to really reduce the carbon. But there's also research and development underway to think about how can we sequester carbon within concrete and really truly make it a carbon neutral material. I think the other side is we've realized the limits of buildings themselves, and in terms of a diminishing returns on energy efficiency. So really looking at carbon and performance from a bigger perspective. I think we'll probably come back to that, but thinking about how we can tie into larger systems and renewable energy grids and energy storage. So some of the equipment that we're bringing into buildings is some of them, like battery storage, for example, is some of the most innovative and impactful at this point.
And Elena, from the people side, the people who are in those buildings think about that or talk about that a little bit, from wellness to just enjoying the space that they're part of.
Yeah. Thank you again for having me today. I find all of those things that Brad was just mentioning to be extremely fascinating. And my architect brain can dive right in, but I'm consistently reminded, like you said, Andy, that people are really the recipients of these buildings, and that there is often a disconnect in the public about how those technical sides of buildings impact our health, our well-being, the way we interact socially with our community, with our neighbors, and the way we deliver on equity within a greater construct. So I think what's interesting to me is, how do we translate these technical solutions to be things that are meaningful to the occupiers and bolster their own health and productivity? But then how do we communicate them and break down the barriers between the architect and these technical designs and to the habitable spaces that we're looking to create? And then how do they communicate with those users, so those users feel empowered to understand their environment better, they feel connected to places in a different kind of way, they can clue into why certain spaces make them feel better than other spaces, and help the occupants connect the dots between healthy real estate and the healthy outcomes or the alternatives of such.
Yeah, I think a good example of kind of this confluence of technology and health is just looking at gas ranges in single family homes or apartments, which is probably the least healthy thing that exists in any residential form. And induction ranges remove the vast majority of that. And we know that people don't use the vents like they're supposed to use them. So, it gets into social equity issues, the confluence of technology, and creating healthier environments, right?
It's a really good example. And something that is very invisible in a lot of ways to the everyday person, right? And I think that we can achieve more with sustainability the more that we can make things visible and the more we can bring them to light and engage occupants in the journey to making more sustainable places.
And Elena and Brad, is that maybe one of the challenges in making our built environment and individual buildings more sustainable, is the sort of challenge on the one hand of a user or occupier, Elena and Brad, who really just wants a building to be comfortable and, but otherwise, not to have to care much about how the building's operating. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, the need for the user occupier to actually, understand that his or her use will affect that building's energy performance or sustainability performance. So on the one hand, I just want mm-hmm. it to work like any kind of technology. I don't necessarily need to know the ins and outs. On the other hand, it's important that users be educated about how these technologies work, whether it's operating a window or, as Andy suggests, a gas versus induction stove. How do you sort of see the squaring that circle?
It's a great question. I think I want to add another layer to it, which is, I think that there's a growing awareness of that the externalities, say, of energy use or carbon emissions, they're hitting home, obviously, where you guys are. You're in Colorado, you're feeling the Western wildfire smoke terribly, as we are in California. So when we're thinking about health and wellness in buildings or outside of buildings, it's, as designers, do we just focus on the individuals that are using the building? Do we focus on those people who are there day one or maybe year 10? Or to what extent are we actually looking at the impacts of the building on human health and wellness beyond specifically those users? Or it circles back to them, because obviously the air quality, both from burning fossil fuels in the building or from contributing to Western wildfires or climate change in general, those are starting to seem more immediate, I think, to people and those impacts. Mm-hmm. But so I'll pause there. Elena, I don't know if you have.
I mean, I agree that the sustainability kind of buzz topic is much more dinner table conversation now than it ever was before because of these undeniable situations that we cannot ignore and, you know, are coming very close to home for a lot of folks. I think it's really interesting the way that LEED created this surgence in environmental focus for our industry. And then the next fad to come was, and I don't mean to call them fads like they're going to go away, but they certainly have ebbs and flows in their popularity. And so, you know, with these wellness certifications, that's a conversation I'm consistently having with clients when they say, should I go for LEED or should I go for WELL? And like, which one matters? What's the market care about now? And it's a delicate balance to say, you know, of course, we are in the middle of a global pandemic. We are dealing with the results of climate change in a very real way, but shifting our attention purely to human health is also not the answer because even in the middle of a global pandemic, the CDC will tell you that the greatest threat to human health is climate change, right? So when we talk about kind of how do we bring everybody along with us so we can generate more change, I think a lot about how do we make sustainability more demonstrable to the public? And make that even more part of the dinner table conversation in a more tactical and impactful way. And sometimes for me, that goes from, okay, well, the everyday person in a building sees recycling and they see sustainability. So how do we do the same thing that we've done with recycling with those triple pane windows, with you know, the gas ranges? How do we do that in a way that is more meaningful than maybe just educational signage? You know,
what role do we play?
To connect those dots.
I also wonder whether we should focus our energies on education or focus our energies on experience. And that, you know, nobody gets too focused on the fact, at least now, that Tesla is an electric car once you're in it. It's just a great car with a really good sound system and a really cool display that goes really fast. And you charge it and plug it in instead of stopping by the gas station. And there's a part of me that thinks that buildings should be the same thing, right? They should be elegant, gorgeous. Most of it should be hidden under the surface. And I'm not sure that everybody has to participate in it and buy in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a really interesting opportunity now for designers to leverage, you know, the consciousness of health and wellness and during the pandemic and the way the ties that has to indoor space or buildings, you know, not having us stay away from offices, let's say. We kind of need to flip the script now and think about how do we talk about the importance of architecture and of buildings for health and wellness. And so they're not dangerous places, they're actually healthy places to be. I think the depth of health and wellness goes far beyond just some measurable things like air quality, which are obviously important, but there's psychological health, emotional health, and those things are correlated with being in community and being in a social environment. So I think there's also there's so many kind of multivalent aspects of health and wellness. And architecture and the value of it for people has been tested for, you know, thousands of years. And it's kind of an opportunity now to, and a lot of that has been just the aesthetic and kind of emotive response that people have to great space. So we can, I guess what I'm saying is that we can get overly hung up on the metrics, but there's actually the value of great architecture being both aesthetic and as a place for community is a key aspect of health and wellness that I think we can articulate perhaps moving forward.
And Brad, would you say, and maybe this is a question for Elena as well, is part of what this new generation of wellness-based or wellness-focused standards about is sort of getting to those less technical, less sort of engineering specific goals of the built environment to promote that psychological, mental, emotional health. And to the extent that is the case, where is sort of the sweet spot between a focus on, you know, energy performance, engineering systems of a sort of more traditional LEED variety and the mental psychological health that a robust wellness set of standards are about. Is there a sweet spot? Do either of you see one as more important than the other these days, or more popular, Elena, as you're suggesting, than the other? Can you give our audience a sense of, you know, how these two sort of work together, a lead focus, a wellness focus, and where do they overlap?
They definitely have some overlaps. Sometimes they have some conflicts where, you know, energy use is needs to be deprioritized or reconsidered in a way to deliver for, let's say, increased air exchanges or something like that. But I don't think they're at odds with each other as much as they're usually aligned with each other. I do think this question about how do you quantify the ROI on investing in health and well-being is one that we're up against less often. I think that the pandemic has helped us with that. I think that the rise of ESG has helped us with that. I think that the Black Lives Matter movement has helped us with how equity and all of these things impact our ability to be successful communities. So to me, more is more. Like, you know, I don't think that there's really, you know, we should put more effort in one to the other. I think it's about making sure that we don't lose one sight of one in lieu of the other. And that even if we can't, I think it's important that we consistently try to measure human health outcomes as proof points and as ways to continue to optimize what it is that we are doing for health and well-being, but not make it dependent on doing it, right? Not make the determination of whether or not we're going to invest in it based on how much data there is. But I think it really is important that we are looking at, you know, ways to quantify it.
Yeah, I'd add a third perspective in there, or a third kind of thing to look at, and that is productivity. And I think that's something that business is starting to really think about. And when you look at what it costs to rent an office building, it might be 5% of your total costs as a business to operate, then 60% is your people or something. And we worked with CoreLogic and actually sat down with them and didn't really sell sustainability or health and well-being. We sold productivity, and we said, if you got a 1% gain in productivity through reduced absenteeism, 1% through recruiting, and 1% by maintaining and retaining your employees longer, that's a 3% improvement in productivity. Not even a true, people are working better or smarter. It's just three simple pieces of their business that paid for most of their rent. And so I think the kind of health and wellness and the technical side and the access to light and air, all those things kind of blend together under that, will you get that 3% productivity growth? And I think that's another piece for business that we're starting to talk about.
I mean, I like to think of that as another way of looking at resilience too, right? Resilience, we're often focused on, you know, how are we going to keep the lights on? But I would argue that resilience is, what's the resilience of your workforce? And are you taking care of them? Are you making them productive? You know, when they go down, your business suffers as a result. So I think we often think about resilience from that technical side, and we should think about that from the human side too.
And I think the overlay of, you know, the conversation that all businesses are having now is, you know, the hybrid work from home model, how productive is that? So it's interesting, Andy, what you were just referring to, I think is, you know, really good research and very, you know, logical and true, trying to think about how that overlays with, if we're really trying to maximize productivity, integrating hybrid work. And as I was talking about before, really being precise about the value of place, the value of architecture, for, you know, why should we come back, especially in the workplace? And I think that this question that, you know, Bill is posing, it's kind of, we have our left brain and our right brain, they work together, and it's a similar thing. It's like the technical execution of envelope, HVAC, that integrated design. I mean, I find it fascinating. I find it an art form, but it's very technical. The architectural design opportunities, I think, around wellness, around biophilia, and that's where the kind of juicy stuff is. And I think we absolutely, I don't see them in conflict whatsoever. And I think that's the challenge of, you know, really great design can juggle a lot of stuff. So there's no reason to think about it as in conflict or as a trade-off in any way.
Well, let's keep going along that same line of, you know, I think offices weren't designed to live in, and a lot of people almost lived in them, and homes weren't really designed to work in. Yeah. And we found that out over the course of the last year and a half. What is that kind of way that we make new homes and new offices, whether they're new or retrofitted, how do they start to explore that new world order?
Especially if, as you were suggesting earlier, Brad,
yeah,
if we're getting more sophisticated about embodied carbon,
yeah,
as a subset of embodied energy, you know, a lot of that embodied carbon in a building is what it actually takes to not only get the materials there, but the people using that building, to the extent we're talking about an office building.
Yeah.
And if the work from home alternative could dramatically reduce the amount of carbon that that building or its occupants represent, you know, how do we then rebalance the system? You know, downtown Manhattan or San Francisco, what is that going to look like? So just sort of thoughts on what this future of work and office and home looks like.
Do you want to jump in, Alina? Or?
Well, I might play the devil's advocate to the productivity that, like, you know, we're all more productive at home because people just keep working until they fall asleep at their computer. And like, so we're more productive, but are we healthier? I don't know, you know?
No. from home, it was live at work.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, especially Lena, when you've got a newborn or an infant around.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or two kids and 800 square feet in a city with no outdoor space. Yeah.
Yeah. We always have to be careful about real estate strategy. Oh, go ahead, Andy. I didn't hear you. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I would argue that over the last year and a half, what most of us have been doing is unsustainable. Right.
Yes.
And
yes.
Not only are people just not likely to continue doing it, but it was, I don't think it was actually more productive, but I also think it was definitely unhealthy. And the only reason people work so hard from home is they couldn't go outside and go do anything. So this future hybrid got to be a little more interesting than what we've been doing the last year.
But I think Bill is absolutely right that it is another opportunity to, again, kind of widen the lens. And so, for example, reducing commute one day, you know, not commuting one day a week, that's a 20% commute emissions reduction. That's huge. You try to do that through any other, measure, and, you know, good. That's that would take a lot of investment, a lot of time to think about new, you know, land use patterns or new transit options. So that's huge in itself. I think it is a good time to again look at what is the, you know, the function of the workplace. I think that it does then tie back into embodied carbon when you look at things like the project I'm working on, that's a big high-tech office. The big change when we stopped, when we restarted, is really an emphasis on flexible furniture systems and the consciousness that we all have of the need for resilience and when we're investing in interiors, to really, we don't know what's coming. We don't know what's coming in a year or 5 years or whatever. And the more we can build in that resilience, it's going to help people adjust. And it's also going to help the interiors from being disposable, which is definitely one of the biggest factors in embodied carbon.
We're designing our new interiors right now. And one of the things we're doing is trying to make it more residential-like, in the sense that we realize we're kind of competing with home. And so I'm interested in your perspectives on how will home change to maybe look more like an office and vice versa.
Especially, Elena, given your interiors expertise, you know, you're so thoughtful about details and what goes where. I mean, what should some of these changes be in light of the impact of COVID going forward?
Yeah, well, I'm just thrilled that the reimagining of our spaces is focused on the people. Right? That, we need to integrate technology and we need flexible furniture and make smart investments because, you know, it was very obvious we don't know what's coming. But the shift is all back to like what do the people need and why will they come here? So I think that that is worth the offset of the, you know, the carbon emissions. I think that they are both important, and in some ways you make the sacrifice. It's kind of like saying we're not all going to go stop using airplanes, right? It's important that we are connected as a world, and that we have we can engage and go places and see other things. But do we need to take that flight for, you know, that meeting that could happen like this, right? You know, let's be more thoughtful, just like when we go to the workplace. Like, I don't need to go there every day just to check the box, punch the card, but I'm going to go there thoughtfully. And that carbon emissions of my going to the office are going to be thoughtful and considered, as opposed to just, you know, business as usual. So I'm delighted that we're going to be more considerate about how we emit carbon in commuting, hopefully, how we are going to reinvent our spaces and really keep them human-centric and hopefully future-focused on flexibility and things like that. And I think you're bringing kind of the residential to the office has been something that people have really responded to for a while now. And I think there's kind of a balance, right? People still like to have some of the features of an office that they don't have at home when they go there, and some of the things that, you know, you want to host a client or things that you wouldn't necessarily have at home. So I feel like it's that combination of making people feel comfortable, but then having the professional and the tools that they need that are that reason that drive them to come together.
Yeah, and I think trying to figure out what is efficiently done at home and what do you need for a home office space, and combining that with what are the things that are really important for an office? What are the functions of the office that are essential? Mm-hmm. When you look at kind of leading edge projects of either what companies are doing or things that you're working in, what are the things that excite you and what are the components that you're working on there? Maybe Brad start first and then Lynn.
Sure. I'm really excited about just the shift that's happening in the consciousness that's changing to going from focusing on energy to carbon. And it's really, and when we do that, companies that are looking at the concept of 24/7 clean energy and really digging a little deeper to think about the sources of their electricity, when that electricity is dirty versus clean, and how that's feeding into their building. So for example, we opened the Sonoma Clean Power headquarters in Santa Rosa. And that project is a pilot study for something called the Grid Optimal Initiative. That's USGBC's involved in that with New Buildings Institute. And basically we're gonna be running the building in a way where it's getting a feed of information about the actual carbon content on the grid. So let's say the obvious example is it's the summer, it's 4 o'clock, it's really hot everywhere, all the air conditioning is pumping. The California grid will start firing up their dirtiest gas powered plants that normally would stay off. So you want to avoid energy use at that time. So the lights are going to dim automatically 20% during those times. And obviously the hot water, the heat pump hot water heater won't turn on during those times. It'll just store the energy. So, and other features too, where there's batteries as well. So I think projects like that, we're also doing something similar on this large technology campus, supporting this corporate client's larger organizational goal to get to carbon neutrality. And they recognize that they have to really think about what kind of energy is being used when in their building. So that's, to me, this really complicated and interesting technical frontier that's being explored at different scales right now. And Andy, I think it one more comment on it. It fundamentally builds on the net zero energy work that you and others have led and that Boulder Common showed, because those projects figured out how do you do an all electric building that's low, you know, uses, you know, low energy, all electric building. And by the way, it has PVs to offset that energy. It turns out the most, I think, impactful aspect of that was how do you do an efficient all electric building? And the energy supply is, there's a lot of more options for that now.
And Elena, what are you seeing out there kind of on the leading edge?
Thank you for that, Brad. I actually, when you were saying, I thought one of the most interesting things about Boulder Commons was it was multi-tenant. So yeah. I'm really interested in like the collaboration of all the people that make this possible. And to me, the most exciting thing are the owners and the occupiers collaborating.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, in the past, it's kind of been, you do your thing, I do my thing, and we have our interests are a little bit separate. And now I'm talking to occupiers where we're talking about, you know, their site selection and their leasing language, and how are they going to communicate what matters to them? Large occupiers who are have a strong presence in the market, right? How can they leverage their position to communicate to building owners that this matters and this is what they're looking for? Simultaneously, I'm working with owners who have never been more excited to meet their tenants in the middle and say, well, wow, I would much rather invest in the efficiency or the health of my building than giving you more tenant improvement dollars, let's say. So I just find that to be like where we're going to accelerate this process is now that I'm seeing real collaborative efforts, and with the rise of ESG and these investors and owners reporting on the performance publicly, the occupiers publicly reporting on their performance, is really, it's the partnership that we've been needing. And so to that end, I've always had a strong interest in how do we scale sustainability and how do we bring it to everyone? Because I've always felt like healthy materials are not something that you should have to be able to call out by name or even know what sustainability means to be worthy of them, right? So in my work, I was always trying to figure out, you know, can we deliver this to everybody? How can we change our general specifications to improve on chemicals of concern or to improve on embodied carbon? And I did a study on general specifications and looking at ubiquitous building materials like drywall and insulation and paint, and asked that question. If I remove the chemicals of concern and if I choose those products prescriptively with the lowest embodied carbon, have I impacted cost or schedule? And can we all just use those products so that we send a message to the market that this is what we value? And if it doesn't cost anymore or take any longer to get that drywall, let's specify that all day long and send a message to all the other folks who make drywall. I'm keen to figure out, you know, which is what I'm working on with these owners and occupiers, because they're all looking at how do we take this to scale? So how do we look at general specifications? How do we look at leasing language? How do we look at facilities management operations and create guidebooks that scale from one project or one building to portfolios of buildings, to communities, you know, to really bring that mainstream and drive market transformation? That gets me fired up.
Represent. That's so good. I love that. So, and there's a lot of idealism, of course, in what you're saying, but there's also sort of nuts and bolts supply demand, right? Which is the equity issue here, right? When we talk about WELL buildings and LEED Platinum buildings, we're still generally talking about, you know, an elite class of buildings accessible only to the most affluent, be they commercial or residential buyers or tenants. As you say, clearly we need the volume, the scale to drive those costs down. Couple of questions. One, is it your sense now as we move beyond, you know, boutique projects, of which I would characterize Boulder Commons, Andy's pathbreaking project, among others, are we moving away from, you know, really boutique toward a more sort of commercialized, broad scale set of products in buildings, and therefore advancing a real equity agenda, access, affordability for all. And Elena and Brad, in terms of your clients, be they building owners or occupiers, are you really in fact seeing this sort of more collaborative spirit in working with other stakeholders to have the best built environment possible? Or is that, again, just sort of a function, Elena, of the sorts of folks you work with? Are you seeing a shift in the market where folks are generally more open to working with others as opposed to, you know, pay me the rent and get out of my face?
What do you think, Brad? Well,
the first part of your question, Bill, in terms of kind of equity or access to these types of buildings, in our practice, we're really trying to shift to a scalable, really trying to find an approach that's scalable and affordable, because for obvious reasons, we're not going to get to a kind of carbon neutral society without it. Exactly. This project I'm going to mention is not exactly a typical, it's a unique project, but it's for the, we're doing the renovation of AIA's national headquarters in DC, and we just started. And partly why we're selected is that we had an approach to achieving their climate goals, which is in support of their climate action plan, that they could afford. Because the original approach that they were going to pursue was about, you know, squeezing as much energy efficiency as possible into the project. And it was quite expensive just to replace all the mechanical systems and really focus on EUI and energy use intensity reduction. So I think the idea that we have to really situate our buildings within the larger community, within the larger electricity grid, and leverage these other systems, and not and find the sweet spot of how we invest in efficiency and not kind of overinvest in that. I think that's becoming the path forward that's going to allow kind of a wider set of building owners to access, you know, the kind of low carbon building. I mean, I think it's really starting with the electrification and then really trying to find ways to leverage other trends going on in society.
Elena?
Yeah, I think those are really good points, Brad. And I think that, you know, projects like Boulder Commons, I like to say they lift the ceiling on what's possible, but it's important that we're always looking at the floor and trying to bring that back up with us, you know? And so that's where back to that education point, Andy, like, does education matter? And is that really, do we just deliver an amazing experience and hope that the user connects the dots, right? Or do we need to help them understand why this is actually better? Like a little bit of looking under the hood a little bit, because then I do think that awareness matters, and that value in why things are better does matter and helps to accelerate what we're trying to achieve here. So I would argue that the educational component and making the public generally aware is a super important piece of this lifting the floor.
No, I would agree. And I think that, you know, I've started to, I would say I'm a, you know, reform net zero person at some level, in that I used to think that the building was the thing and we had to do a bunch of those. And where I've really kind of broken the world into pieces right now for me is, and I think it gets into both how we design and build and how we educate people to it, is for me, I think about what do buildings consume in terms of energy? And we want to get them to where they consume as little as is practical. And then what can they practically produce on site? And, you know, it depends on where they are in the country and what grid they're connected to and what the grid is going to look like in 20 and 30 years in that location. And then how do we manage them for people and optimize them for energy, kind of are the three major components. And then I would say everything we're doing right now is saying, how do we take, I would never do another not all electric building. You know, it's kind of, once we've done electric, we put gas lines in the first couple, just in case. We don't put gas lines in any of them anymore, just in case. And, right. And now our question is, how do we make it scalable, replicable, and reduce the cost on each project going forward, such that we're working from kind of a leading edge platform? We'll probably get down into the medium size, right, or the mean. I don't know that we'll be working on the lowest cost projects to bring them up. But I think what I've seen happen is by working kind of from an exploratory phase and then kind of trying to commoditize that, it's also crossing a curve that there's enough volume in things like electric heating and cooling systems and others, that their price is coming down along at the same time. So I think you're right. It's education, it's kind of trying to make these more of a commodity strategy. And then what happens in the supply and demand of the world is if people want more of that, eventually its cost is going to come down due to demand and local and regional suppliers and skilled labor that knows how to put it in now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the big play is really of demonstration projects, demonstrating that projects can be done cost effectively, can then influence codes. And that's really the kind of end game. If we're talking about how to move the market and move replicability, is if you have a project like the project in California, the Packard Foundation, which dramatically influenced the California Energy Code, because we showed things that actually could work. So 10 years later, the code was adopted, and a project like Boulder Commons can have the same impact, I'm sure, in Colorado. I think that's where then you get the economy of scale, because once something is codified, of course, the manufacturers and the cost curves start aligning.
It's a lot harder to put human health and well-being into the building code, for sure. And the government and those who make the building codes are much more invested in our grids and our energy systems, water and waste and all of that. So it is harder. And it goes back to that qualitative piece, like, how do you measure it? But it is harder to rely on the codes to look after your health and well-being. And so I would say to kind of carry on to Andy's thought and yours is, how do you share those lessons learned to the next developer that might consider it? And how do you accelerate the sharing of those lessons to make sure that the supply and demand can respond accordingly to your lessons and make those multiply? And an example of that I have is the same thing with that research project I did looking at ubiquitous materials. Is there was a great drywall brand out there that also had a component to it that it could absorb formaldehyde in the atmosphere. So it could absorb and actually like clean the air to some extent, like take some toxins out of the air, particularly during off-gassing, and store them within the drywall. And then it had low embodied carbon and had no chemicals of concern. Awesome product. I tested it. It came in on time, at budget. And then the next time I went to go use it, that wasn't available anymore. And when I talked to the manufacturer, they said, yeah, it was a great product, but it wasn't getting specified enough. And it had a separate machine or some process that it required that if it didn't have the scale, we couldn't make it anymore. And I was like, well, this is the case of, supply and demand not working the way that we need it to. So my goal with that project was, Greenbuild didn't happen last year, but the goal was to present it at Greenbuild and share all of those specs. That is not my secret sauce as a designer, is to know the best drywall spec. That is the kind of information that we as an industry should just be sharing. And I think sometimes we need to find better avenues to share these things, because each architecture firm is working on their own little set of notes here on the side, or their own Excel spreadsheet. And like, how do we scale that impact.
Elena, that goes to your sort of collaboration ethic, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's, I'm noticing that among the four of us, you're the only woman. So as perhaps we see more women in the
That's
field,
true.
In positions of leadership, collaboration will begin to overtake competition as the order of the day. But a couple of points, Brad, going back to your excellent point about code and policy as a great scaling mechanism. I say that as a lawyer, believing that, there's nothing better than writing something into law to get people to do it or not do it, as the case may be. Let's note that this very week, right, California is proposing the requirement that all new buildings have a solar component, right? So as usual, California sort of taking the lead, upping demand, and thus supply, bringing costs down. So there is a real virtue to that move. Brad or Elena, being both Californians, do you have thoughts on the latest from California in terms of promoting renewables in the built environment?
Well, it's also that the California Energy Commission, the maybe the biggest, most impactful move on that is that they're setting electric heat pumps as the baseline in the code.
Yeah.
And so everything has to be measured against that, which is completely flips on its head. It's been almost impossible to do a kind of prescriptive code basis using electric heat pumps in the past. So that's a fundamental change that's, completely turning things on its head. I want Elena, feel free to answer, but I'm really intrigued on the code question, because Elena just mentioned how it's harder to get kind of health and wellness into the code than some of these energy issues. what's interesting is that the history of codes, in the beginning, building codes were there to protect,
to protect us
and wellness. That was it. That's public why health. They started.
Yeah, public so health.
It just hit me when you said that. Like, oh, that's it is true, and it's perverse because that's the whole point of codes.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there are any thoughts that you have, Elena. Sorry to not to be the interviewer here, but if there are things that we could potentially advocate to codify around, wellness in codes.
Well, where isn't it sad? Sorry, Elena, just to add to that question for you, Elena, it's what Lee tried to do essentially for energy codes and has done successfully, right? A market transformation measure in a certification system that eventually gets absorbed and adopted by public policy, largely around energy. Might we not see the same, Elena, around wellness standards with WELL certification and other similar certifications working largely through the private sector, but ultimately sort of percolating up to local and state codes?
It depends on how you're thinking about delivering wellness. There are design strategies that I don't think the code can ever, it's going to be a lot harder to integrate design strategies, active design and, daylighting and biophilia. Those are going to be a harder, more qualitative. They're harder to prescribe for the building code. And then there's the other component that's somewhat invisible, which are those chemicals of concern and which are, what we make. There's like 100,000 chemicals out there in the world, and most of them have not been tested for their impact.
And the chemical lobby.
And we're up against, manufacturing and chemical lobbies. So I think the best thing that we can do is share amongst ourselves and try to, use capitalism to our advantage to actually promote those healthier materials and the natural materials and use more natural and less new generated manufactured products, with all the latest, like sometimes just using that piece of wood was the better choice.
Taking a page from the organics playbook, right? In the food industry.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. If your grandma didn't know what that building material was, maybe you want to think twice about using
it. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Simple ingredients.
I think I've become more optimistic lately in the sense of how much collaboration is going on. And it kind of gets to your point, Elena, on the education. How do we educate each other? In that, there's people who are doing pilot projects that they're trying to commoditize like we are. There are officials around the country really focusing on energy through code and other mechanisms to improve that. I think that the real focus on health, wellness, and productivity is probably going to be driven by large companies that will demonstrate that that can work, and it will be adopted by smaller companies. And I've also talked a lot to institutional investors recently, and I used to think that they were going to be the last ones to be part of this game, but they're going to become the kind of gorilla in the room pretty soon, because they're starting to think about not only their ESG goals, but the normal lifetime of a loan on a building is somewhere between 12 and 15 years. And who wants to be the one holding the bag in the next cycle that has a fossil fuel powered building?
That a gas range.
So I think we're at kind of an interesting confluence. I'm optimistic at this point in time.
That's saying something. That's
we awesome. Are. I say to investors, you can focus right now on your green premium, or tomorrow we can talk about your brown discount.
Yeah. Nice.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, we should make hats.
Elena, you are, right? you are chock full of really good, one-liners tonight or today. I love that. I want to just get to a sort of related subject, but maybe take us in a slightly different direction. Because of what's happening now, Brad, you referred to yet again, wildfires from California and the West Coast affecting us here in Colorado, to say nothing of the rest of the country. This is now essentially a perennial phenomenon. The science suggests so, our lived experience suggests so. COVID, of course, upped the ante on the conversation about the relationship between indoor and outdoor space. Many of us, in fact, I think all of us in the last year have had this conversation on specific projects. In light of COVID, how do we take better advantage of outdoor space? Well, of course, we can have that conversation and then we look out the window or go outside and it's smoggy and hot. Yeah. Like this is a really sort of wicked challenge right now. So I'd love to explore for a few minutes this sort of question of interior to exterior, outdoor to indoor, as we look at a hotter, smokier planet, or at least parts of the planet, and what the challenge will be for developers and designers and policymakers in terms of finding that, again, that right balance between indoor and outdoor space, whether it's a pandemic or a wildfire. Is there a sweet spot? Is flexibility the watchword? So it's not just, Brad, as you're suggesting, sort of, you know, flexible furniture systems for inside or perhaps even outside, but it's flexible indoor-outdoor systems, you know, more sliding doors and more outdoor space that can be made indoor and more indoor that can be made outdoor, and a lot more filtration, I guess, you know, sort of at the end of the day, in and out. So your thoughts on sort of indoor-outdoor and what the hotter, smokier world is going to require us to do to be both sustainable and healthy?
It's incredibly problematic. It can be solved with, I mean, the obvious answer, money aside, is flexibility, being able to shut everything down, have really good air filtration, and then open things up when you can and be outside. Mm-hmm. It can add up from a cost perspective, just to even an one operable window adds cost versus a fixed window, right? Just on a base level. But we do have to, build in good air filtration into our building systems. We can't rely on operable windows anymore and just purely passive approach. That's my perspective. And I think that, you know, from a biophilia standpoint and a functionality standpoint, finding ways to allow a fluidity between inside and outside in most, almost all climates is really high value.
Yeah, it's interesting. They said that the house plant sales went through the roof during COVID, yeah. Right? So we all needed to bring the outside inside with us, you know, because we weren't leaving our homes enough. Interestingly, you know, studies have shown that those folks in a hospital bed, even with a picture of nature, heal faster than those with none, right? So I'm not suggesting we move to like wallpapers of the outside environment instead of actually going outside, but it does reiterate that value to our human, you know, the ability to regenerate and thrive is connected to us being living creatures that inherently like evolved outside, right? So I think if anything, this isn't really an answer to your question, but if anything, all of these situations just make us realize how precious nature actually is and the outdoors actually are. When you can't access them, then, you know, that need and desire is even stronger than you had before. So, and going back to what Andy said about, you know, are the institutional investors the gorilla in the room? I think they are one of the gorillas in the room. And the other gorilla that I have my eye on is the next generation, because what to us feels like, oh God, this is starting to happen every year, is their lived reality. That is what they know the world to be. And they can hear from us that that's not really what it used to be. And there's an injustice there, right? And what the other thing that I see the young folks doing, I'd like to think that I'm one, but I don't think I am anymore, is they connect all of these issues in a way that none of us ever did before. So the intersectionality of these issues, you know, how social justice, environmental justice, you know, Native people's rights, all of these sort of interrelated issues, you know, Black Lives Matter, I mentioned before, they all come down to issues that we're talking about and that historically capitalism has played a big role in perpetuating. So that's why I'm so keen to use capitalism to our advantage. And how do we communicate and how do we drive positive change that has also a triple bottom line positive result? Right. So those investor, I love that we have the two gorillas in the room are the institutional investors and the next generation who are going to push them to do better.
And do you see this, Elena? Elena, do you see this happening in terms of our particular industry, whether it's developers or designers in your case? I mean, thinking back to planning and architecture schools and real estate programs, are we seeing, and I have my own perspective on this, a real shift generationally and therefore in consciousness that will start showing up in a much bigger way at scale, say, you know, within the next decade or two, so that every designer and every developer is already, you know, thinking in these collaborative, flexible, sustainable terms versus, you know, having to be persuaded and coaxed till the cows come home.
Yeah, and they're clued into it. And that's why I say, how can we educate them to have those real solutions and really understand they are keen to know and keen to apply those lessons. So how do we, as the folks who have lived them and learned them, share them so they can use those as launching platforms to take them where we never dreamed they could? And I think that it's inherently kind of who they are, right? So let's like tap into that power.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we all forget is kind of the power of generational change. And, you know, I think you can look back to see it as well as be optimistic looking forward about what's going to happen. And I take an example like when Bill Ford became the president of Ford Motor Company, right? Their focus in terms of buildings and sustainability changed dramatically. He helped push them towards better materials and technology. And ultimately, I think you can probably link the new Ford Lightning pickup truck back to him at some level. And they have 100,000 orders for something that hasn't even been created yet. So, generational change is huge.
And he also hired Bill McDonough, right, for the River Rouge factory to really experiment with cradle-to-cradle design for an auto manufacturer.
Yeah, and it took a new generation in that business to adopt and fully embrace that change. And I think that, you know, the development business is historically kind of a stodgy business, right? But we need a new generation of people that kind of came into a world of, wow, all electric is probably the way to go. And let's start divesting of or renovating these fossil fuel powered buildings. And the generation after that is going to say, we powered buildings with fossil fuel?
Yeah. It's so exciting.
Change, right?
And there's the time clock, though, right? Which is the particular urgency of the matter today, as many would describe it, which is, you know, we can't wait for generational change and the shift in DNA. We need some old dogs, new tricks.
We don't. I agree with everything, and we can't wait for the next generation to take charge. I mean, the four of us and others are making the buildings happen right now. So one key area that really impacts today is embodied carbon. And I'm curious, and so Lena's talking about, you know, harnessing capitalism, which I agree. This is an area that's really thorny because it doesn't really impact the productivity of the worker. It doesn't impact your energy costs. Creating the financial case for it is very hard because it's not codified and there's not incentives. So as a developer, Andy or William, I'm curious from you guys, like, you guys are diehard, so you'll do it, but how do we quickly make embodied carbon something that can be mainstream and, you know, reducing it can be something that is actually happening on a wide scale, because that's the carbon that gets emitted up front, which is the thing we have to address more than anything.
I mean, for me, as someone who is often cautious of government solutions or policy solutions rather than private sector solutions, I think carbon is one of the areas that's going to largely be driven top down, I hope, from federal policy and filter through states and local government. And I think whether it's a pure carbon tax or some variance on that, I think that's probably what's necessary to make it happen as quickly as we need it to happen.
Yeah. Even Lindsey Graham and Mitt Romney apparently can agree that that's probably the only way to go, Brad.
Yeah.
As a policy solution, a tax on carbon to really target it, pinpoint it. Elena, your thoughts?
Well, I was wondering if Brad was going to ask Andy if he's planning to redesign existing building stock to tap into all that embodied carbon.
You know, I
like
think
reimagine it in, yeah. and show that example that our clients don't need to look to build a new building, that, that exactly. they can take an old dog and literally give it all new tricks, right? And how do we transform that and create amazing examples of like, wait, that was what, you know, and that to me is so exciting.
Yeah, we're doing it right now, and we're converting a building from gas to electric, and you have to look at, we can't just convert buildings to electric and have them consume three times as much energy as a good building. So you've got to figure out a way to do the envelope incrementally, and you've got to figure out a way to do the heating and cooling system often incrementally, because you have tenants and they have leases and they have rights, and it's complicated. I mean, I like to finish on a high, but kind of the downer of our business right now is that all the new buildings are a lot of fun. They're really interesting. They're leading edge. You know, they represent what, something like less than 1% of all buildings each year. So yes. what do we do with the other 90-some percent, and how do we do those over this 15 or 20 year period? And I think you can't just regulate it, because the unintended consequences could be so high and people could delay. And so I think really figuring out a good path to retrofits that maybe doesn't let perfect get in the way of good terms of achieving our goals for 2030 or 2050.
It is so complicated. Brad, as Andy, you'll recall, Brad was part of a conversation and a project that Elena, that the three of us were working on as recently as what, 6 or 8 months ago, trying to convince a city, and I'll leave names out, that saving an existing building was actually a more sustainable, greener alternative than the sustainable deconstruction of that same building. So talk about a conundrum and a challenge. A very sophisticated, well-funded, sustainable deconstruction strategy versus simply leaving at least the building shell in place to be adaptively reused. In fact, Brad did some really nice sketches and massing studies. We ultimately were not successful in convincing said city that it was more cost-effective and more sustainable to keep the building than to sustainably deconstruct it. So the retrofitting and re-engineering of existing building stock, you know, it turns out is really perhaps the most challenging assignment that we will have going forward.
And the most urgent, because we can't afford right now, until we really get our research and development on things like, you know, low carbon concrete really humming, and we just can't really afford to be building new buildings with conventional structural materials. I mean, I know Andy's been doing some work, and I've been doing, EHD is doing work on mass timber at some larger scales, and that's exciting. And
yeah,
actually, I'm surprised to say, I think it actually has legs. I think it's scalable and workable. But we need, you know, a lot more solutions like that for the new buildings. And I think we need to keep showing great examples. Again, it goes back to the kind of case study and exemplary projects and the value of that, just showing examples of fantastic, healthy, you know, great environments for people that are in existing buildings that have been transformed. I think it's a really high priority.
Yeah, and I think we, just before we talked about, are we asking too much of buildings? Like, what are we expecting of them? And I would say we're maybe not asking enough, that like architects should not be thinking about, they should be thinking about the next 100, 200 years of that building, if not more, really, because it should go through some reinventive cycles, right? And it should get reimagined, and it shouldn't just be discarded for the next thing that might be there for 30, 40 years, right? And so the more examples that we can have to show that, and the more that, you know, that developers and investors see that as a really valuable opportunity, and then kids go to architecture school and they're like, oh, let's do projects where we reimagine existing buildings instead of designing brand new ones. Like, let's change the whole conversation, because to your point, we're not going to get out of this problem by building more buildings.
And yet again, that sounds wonderful and compelling. And we can think about Roman ruins and the viaducts and, you know, the great temples of the Far East. But I think, you know, one of the big takeaways for me in this conversation is flexibility, right? The adaptability of the built environment. Given the unpredictability of the kinds of changes and influences that these buildings will be subject to. So can we have our cake and eat it too, which is designing and developing for legacy, for long-term multi-generational durability, but also ensure that those same buildings, down to the building material, can be swapped out, can be changed and adapted as our technologies improve, as environmental conditions change, right? That to me seems to be a really interesting and nearly impossible design assignment.
Well, to me, it's the kind of endless design assignment, right? Is that we live in a world that's constantly changing, constantly evolving, and we've got to get buildings to go that same direction and know that they're in a continuous evolution and that things are designed to be changed and modified incrementally over time, time being hundreds of years. And I think for me, there's also this, you could say, well, let's not worry so much about the new leading edge stuff. But that also informs and is ultimately going to create many of the materials and strategies for the renovations. And we're testing a new glass in one of our next phases. And we've got eight little 18-inch by 18-inch panels in. And it's a film that instead of rejecting the sun, absorbs it and creates energy. So you've got to put a film in our windows anyway, and we're trying to reject heat. Here, let's capture it and turn it into energy instead of rejecting it. Now, a typical solar panel is 24% efficient, right? These are only 6% efficient, but they think they could get to maybe 12% efficiency in the next couple of years. And if you think about the fact that they cost half as much as a solar panel, on every high rise in, you know, every city, we can do a solar study and decide which buildings should have solar windows in them. And now you start thinking in scale and retrofit in producing energies, not just rooftop solar. And it's not some of what we did early, which sometimes looks a little strange. The next version looks a little bit better as you're doing solar walls. But when they're solar windows, again, nobody even knows they're there. They just produce energy, and the next generation won't remember windows that didn't produce energy. That's where I'm pretty optimistic.
Andy, that's a great final thought or near final thought. Folks, we've just got a couple of minutes as we wind down. I love that optimistic note. Elena and Brad, other sort of notes of hope and promise?
I think we've covered a lot of ground here, but I do think that, you know, the immediacy of climate impacts that people are feeling is tragic, and in some ways is our only hope right now, because we have to catalyze this moment, both the transformational moment that's happened because of COVID and kind of shifting concepts of home and work, and there's a lot of kind of movement around that now, and this immediacy across the country and the world of, you know, issues of resilience. And so I think, you know, this kind of podcast and people really speaking up and making those connections, this is the moment.
And great luck. We'll be seeing you soon, I hope, on all sorts of fronts. But thanks for spending an hour or so with us today. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for all the work you both do as well.
Next time, Rashad Nanavati and Ben Holland of the Urban Transformation Team at the Rocky Mountain Institute join us to explore the connection between transportation and land use, and how each affects our ability to achieve our climate goals.